listening to In Layman's Terms, a podcast dedicated to stories of discipleship, news from the United Methodist Church, and lessons from Scripture. I'm your host, Todd Seifert, and as the Communications Director in the Great Plains Conference and a certified lay minister in the UMC, it's my privilege to share these reflections with you. The United Methodist Church is finally scheduled to conduct its general conference from April 23rd to May 4th, 2024 in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's been 8 years since delegates from the annual conferences around the world have gathered to sort through legislation related to governance and the witness of the denomination. Thanks to the COVID-19 pandemic and related issues regarding visas for people from outside the United States, we've had postponement after postponement. So in 2024, we are finally gathering with what will be known as the 2020 General Conference. The 862 delegates, including 14 clergy and laity from the Great Plains Conference, will sort through more than 1,800 pages of legislation, many of those pages containing proposed changes to the United Methodist Book of Discipline. Now, while there are many topics, three have risen to the top of the minds of many people. They are removal of restrictive, some would say harmful, language from the discipline regarding LGBTQ+ persons. One is regionalization, which is a process meant to provide flexibility and better equity across the denomination. And finally, revision of the denomination's social principles, which are statements of stances the denomination takes on current events and concerns. This is the first major revision to that document in decades. Originally, I had intended to take one episode for each of those topics, but all three of those subjects are so intertwined that it felt like separating them left out some important context from each of my guests. So instead, you get a chance to binge a little bit here with five episodes about the upcoming General Conference. You'll hear discussions between myself and Reverends Adam Hamilton, Mark Holland, Amy Lippolt, and David Livingston, as well as Great Plains Conference lay leader Lisa Maupin. In each case, we address their concerns and their thoughts on those three subjects, known to many as the three R's. In this episode, Lisa Maupin provides her perspective as a veteran of General Conference and as a layperson in the United Methodist Church. Here's my conversation with Lisa. Let's start with the idea of regionalization, because that's the overarching thing that could have an impact beyond just this one General Conference. From a layperson's perspective, but somebody who knows what they're talking about, what are your thoughts on regionalization? Why is it important, and what do you think the benefits could be going down the road?
So regionalization is an interesting conversation, especially within the structure of the U.S. a kind of perspective, only because we tried it, right? This was even before I was doing General Conference. I think it was in 2008, potentially, that we ran it. It passed through General Conference, but then it has to, because it was a constitutional thing, right? It has to go back to the annual conferences, and that's where it didn't pass, which will back up into that whole process and piece there. So regionalization has always been part of the conversation. I think it becomes even more critical now in this idea of regionalization within the context of who we are as the United Methodist Church now. And from the layperson perspective, it's critical and really important when you back it up and think about it. So yes, there is that whole discussion, oh, it adds another layer of structure and all of those pieces, parts, but it adds a layer of structure to allow a nimbleness and flexibility that we currently don't have. So the way I like to think of regionalization is this is the opportunity for us to be able to, us as the church, as not just clergy, but as laity, as the whole piece, be able to be given permission and encouraged to be able to do what we need to do in the mission context and the mission fields as we define them. So it actually is a permission-giving piece, right? So we are not encumbered by what culturally is appropriate somewhere else.
They're not incumbent then on what's
culturally appropriate for us, right? So what affects us, and while we care deeply about each other's issues because we are children of God and we are a global church, there are certain things that encumber our ability to actually to reach out into our mission fields and our mission context by not being regionalized, by not having some guidelines, some structures, some almost mini social principles per se, that are really focused on our areas and our worlds and our viewpoints and our structures. So in a way, when I look at regionalization, I see it as permission giving. I see it as the ability and the opportunity that exists within it so that we can, so that we as a church, wherever our we exist, our locates, our communities are located, can actually do our work in our mission context, in our mission fields as we define them, right? And reach out into the communities as we define them and as the communities need us to reach out and to be engaged and be present in them. So in a lot of respects, it opens up, by adding this extra structure, right, it opens up our possibilities. It opens up our ability to reach into worlds that we actually are not able to do by being such this huge global beast that has to try to honestly, like, oversee everything. Now we're breaking it up into little chunks.
It is kind of interesting. As I look at it, it does add another layer, but in a way that layer allows for nimbleness that
right.
The overall structure right now does not.
Yes, right. It actually makes the church, the United Methodist Church, a lot more nimble and responsive, right? I think we can react and respond quicker and better and with more intention with that idea of having that structure that helps guide us and not having this huge beast that's trying to guide everybody. Now, that huge beast is going to still exist because it's the overarching piece. But as you go into that regional, it just gives a lot more permission giving and opportunities for us to engage in the mission context and the mission field as we need to.
Mm-hmm. So regionalization, the other thing we should point out is that the United States is really the only one that doesn't have that ability.
Right, which is also a whole nother thing to think about when you back that up and think about how we're the only ones that are not engaged in a regional-like structure. For whatever reasons we want to name them, for historical reasons, for all kinds of pieces, parts. But you can now see if you added that layer, and because the United States is not one that exists under it, put us in that and think about what we can do with that. Ways that we can actually develop some guidelines, some social principles, some moments of engagement and governance that are very opportunistic for our areas and in within that responsiveness. I just think it makes us a much more responsive church and a church that gives us the opportunities, again, for engagement that and permission to engage that we can't always do right now.
Opponents of regionalization, which, if we're just honest, are primarily the very conservative wing, in some cases flat out WCA and Good News folks who have remained for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of speculation as to why. We're not going to get into that right now.
Mm-hmm.
You can go look for that on your own. There's plenty out there.
Right.
Trust me. But they have tried to tie this together with, oh, this has to do with removing the restrictive language from the Book of Discipline. Whether or not that's the case, could that be one of the things that helps with it? Yes, maybe so. But let's look beyond this, the one issue. Regionalization is not just for this one topic. This is something that could have a lot of positive ramifications for the denomination years and years and years from now on things that we don't even know about yet.
Right, right. And so I think you think about it in terms of just think about the different cultural context in which those of us within the United States live, and as opposed to those in the Philippines or those in the continent of Africa. Now, I am saying continent of Africa because mm-hmm. I am very conscious in understanding that within the continent of Africa, there is cultural differences that none of us from our U.S. perspective understand, right? But you think about the differences within those that nature, right? And you think about just even like roles of women. You think about financial differences, socioeconomic differences. What affects us in the United States on socioeconomic factors is very different than what affects us in the Philippines or on the continent of Africa, right? You think about terms, like I said, role and rights, gender rights, issues on what we, in our context of the United States, in terms of racial differences and discussions and conflicts that exist within that. You think about just even how we organize ourselves and what makes sense to organize ourselves within even just the laws of our government, right? And how we even organize ourselves as a church and laws of our government, the expectations on pensions, the expectations on healthcare, all of those pieces, parts that we just, living in the lens that we have from the United States perspective, makes sense to us, do not necessarily make sense to other entities and other global natures. Likewise, what they live under and what worlds and cultural contexts that they, and government contexts that they live under, do not make sense to us, you know, and it's just one of those things that I think it allows, again, that nimbleness and flexibility that we just don't have right now.
So correct me if I'm wrong, Lord knows I'm wrong a lot.
So am I.
But when it comes to this also, could it not also provide some of the cover for folks in, let's say, the African continent or the Philippines, where their context for ministry are very different than, let's just face it, a more liberal United States?
Exactly.
To where they wouldn't have to necessarily, I mean, we can't speak for like what will their governments do, that kind of thing. But one of their concerns is that, you know, for example, in some countries on the African continent, it's still a punishable by law offense to be a practicing homosexual.
Exactly.
But this could provide them with some of the cover, because all of a sudden, oh, those wacky Americans are doing whatever they're going to do in their region. We don't do that here in Africa.
And also think about that, that in the context of how we fellowship with each other. That bridge by understanding of saying, we understand that you cannot engage in the same way that we want to engage, right? We understand that your government or your cultural context is so starkly different. We need this to happen for ours, but we understand that if we enforce this onto yours, there are dire consequences. So I also see it as a bridge building and a fellowship of pulling the family, in a way, our church family, closer together, because now we're understanding each other and not trying to impose things on each other because of our needs and what we need to do, right? Everybody needs to do things in their ministry context. But now this is a fellowship bridge builder in a lot of respects. I think you will see the family pulling closer together in that understanding, like, now we get each other and understand each other a little bit greater because we're not coming in. Our personal agendas are being removed by that regionalization, allowing us to have those discussions.
In a lot of ways, it would be allowing us to make one more step toward ending the colonialization of the African continent, right?
Oh, yes. The colonialization of the church in general, kind of thing. Let's just be honest in that. It also, I think it actually... Could you imagine the beauty of a general conference in which we can meet for 2 weeks and discuss our hopes and our dreams and our future and how we want to go forward and not argue about something that we have been arguing about and never been able to come to a conclusion that is beneficial for everybody for my entire lifetime?
Literally since the year I was born.
Right. I do not know the church without this conflict. That is, there's so many layers of that is just disheartening and sad and horrible. But imagine that my entire lifetime, because we have had this conflict, think about what we are missing out on being able to, as a global body, discuss the hopes and the dreams and the ability to move forward as this family of God in a world that's crying out for us.
Mm-hmm. At the crux, I shouldn't say that. This is the presenting issue. It's not the actual. I don't know as we really know for sure what the underlying causes of our unrest have been, but for whatever reason, the proxy has become acceptance of LGBTQ+ persons, both as terms of same gender weddings and in self-avowed, I'll use the language in the discipline, self-avowed practicing homosexuals practicing as pastors in our churches. One of the many, some of the many pieces, of legislation right now for this general conference is to repeal a lot of the harmful language that's in there. Tell me a little bit, I know you're passionate about that too, so tell us a little bit about what your hope is for that and maybe what that would mean, in your opinion, for people in the United Methodist Church.
So I carry with me to the general conference floor some very personal stories of what my hopes are. My hopes are, it always will come back, is my hopes are to have the ability for everyone in our church to be able to know that they are a child of God, know that they are loved, but also given permission to do what they to do their ministry that they are called to do by God. We are not called to do the same ministry, right? In the mission context, as they have defined them. No, those mission contexts are never the same, as they should not be, right? Mm-hmm. To be able to do that. I carry with me, though, good friends, a really good friend who is in the United Methodist Church with a child that, to be honest with you, I want her child to be able to know that there's a church that loves beyond just their local church, right? That loves them, that accepts them, that there is a home for them wherever they can land and decide to land. That church hasn't turned their back on them, right? And that loves and accepts them as a whole person. And that's always that. And I carry that story. I carry other stories with me. All of that. My advocacy has always come from that place of those that I know, that I just want them to be able to have that faith, acceptance, and love and openness that they can be, right? But and so removing the restrictive language helps into that process, right? Please know that what we understand too is words matter and are very important. So removal of that restrictive language is a freeing moment. However, that is not the end of the work, right? And so we honor that. So we can remove the restrictive language, and then we make the cultural shifts that we need to within the churches that need to make want to make those cultural shifts. Right, there are churches within our denomination, within our structure, within our conference, who are not comfortable with that. But I want them to also know that there's a home for them in the United Methodist Church. But what we need to do, right, is open it up it is part of who they have been called to be, where their ministry context has been defined, where they want to do outreach. They are now given permission to do so freely and without punishment.
One of the things we've talked about with some of our other guests is the idea that it's not like the legislation all of a sudden becomes pro. All it does is remove language that has become restrictive and enforces penalties on one group of people.
Right.
I think that's an important point.
It is a very important point. I think it's an important point that says just with the removal of the restrictive language doesn't mean there's a forcing you out of your comfort zones or your ministry context, right? What it does allow is those that have had been restricted within their ministry context to be able to do their ministry just as freely as others have been able to do theirs without punishment. And I think that's part of it. I think it matters too for those on the outside that are kind of questioning, looking for a home. It matters to them that the language is there or not there, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think we think of it too as this struggle is not just a struggle within the context of our denomination, but the world is watching. A lot of people are watching us.
Right. And so far, all they've seen is this fight.
All they see is a fight, right? They see the worst of the church. They don't see the beauty of the United Methodist Church. They don't see the beauty of the United Methodist Church that has stood out and stood up for and used its voice to make great change, right? They don't see a church that allows us to question, to think, to form our own ideas, the quadrilateral, right? Like to geek out the moment kind of thing, that encourages us to read scripture, to dissect it, to ask questions about it, and to form a way of doing work. That's what they don't see. The parts of the United Methodist Church that we love and we hold dearly, the outside world doesn't see that. They see the conflict and the struggle.
Which, by the way, are the pieces that we agree on.
Isn't that right, interesting? Right. Who we are as Wesleyan, like, you know, United Methodists with our Wesleyan principles, those are the parts that we agree on and we hold dear. And that's why what I always remember is, even in the heart of the battles, when there is someone that does not see the world the same way as I do, right? Especially on the floor or in the committee work or discussions or interactions at any point in time. I remember this, and I hold this too. They love the church just as much as I do. Mm-hmm. They are passionate for the United Methodist Church just as much as I am. We are just coming at it from different perspectives, and we see the world differently, and that is where the conflict rises. But it doesn't mean that neither one of us love the church any less, or with any less passion, or those basic core principles. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes this whole thing so hard, because this is your family.
Right. Well, as we've talked with a couple of our other guests, the local churches and our families do this actually fairly well. We disagree on things. We still come together. Thanksgiving meal might be a little awkward, but we're all there. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, we have not been able to do that so far. I wonder, as someone, just so everybody knows here, Lisa gets out a lot. She visits a lot of our local churches, and not just in Nebraska. That's where she lives, but she's been at churches in Kansas too. But she interacts with a lot of laity, and she has the opportunity to talk to them. And what I guess I'm getting with this is, we have so many people from so many different areas, mm-hmm. different backgrounds. The whole quadrilateral that she talked about there. So if you need the refresher, it's scripture, tradition, your experience, and reason. In other words, don't check your brain at the door. We get that opportunity when we interact with people and we get to see. So as you're going around talking to folks in an era post-disaffiliation, or at least the wave of disaffiliation is behind us, what are you seeing as you talk to folks? What are some of the concerns or some of the celebrations that they're lifting up to you?
Oh, that's such a hard question because it's so many things. I think one of the things too, I think backing up, yes, like the talk and everything, I think we should talk also about experience too. I grew up in a small rural community in the western part of our conference. That is no longer, the church that I grew up in is no longer United Methodist. So I think I want to say that straight out. So I grew up in probably a very traditional sense of church. Right. So people hear that, oh, she's from Lincoln. They see it more as, oh, she's from more of an urban setting kind of thing.
Right,
they
right.
hear the conversation that we just had about what my hope, you know, with the restrictive language. Just know that there's that perspective. So I carry that tradition, that history. You carry that with you to influence a lot of things. And so I think when you hear things, I think there's the fears are coming from the idea that if the restrictive language is removed, that forces me into somewhere I'm not comfortable, which is what we discussed is not the case, right? But it is permission giving and releasing for those that are living under the restrictiveness, right? And we want them to do well. We want them to thrive. What we really want to do is we want to thrive as a denomination, right? We want our churches to thrive. We want our numbers to grow, all of this. And so
because
part of
this— Because it means we're being a stronger witness for Christ. That's
right.
What all those things mean.
Yes, it really does. And in different mission fields that, you know, we need to be in, right? Like, we're not, you know, in that, it's not a selection process kind of thing. So, but what I hear, there's those fears. What I also hear in this, that, and then there's the pain that came out of the disaffiliation process brought what we knew was happening in General Conference for our lifetime to the local church. Mm-hmm. And it played out in really weird ways But it plays out in weird ways at General Conference, right? The thing is that we were able to, those of us who have been to General Conference multiple times and engaged in the geek out process that comes with it, there are times that that's General Conference, you compartmentalize it and you go back to your local church where you're like, yes, this is what we mean, right?
There's a little sense of, because it's home, there's a little sense of calm and peace.
Yeah, but also like, this is why you come back to your people and you're like, this is why I do this, right? But now that came into the local church. And so I think that there's that pain and that struggling through those discussions bubbled up into a surface. They were always there, but it came into the local church setting. So there's pain and healing that it has to come from that, right? When suddenly the person that you thought you knew who sat next to you isn't who you knew. You talk about the churches that take, I've spent a year in interview process with churches that have taken disaffiliation votes that did not pass. Mm-hmm. And I spent a year in conversations with multiple, I can't even count how many times I've cried on a Zoom call listening to the stories of these churches across our conference that have taken these votes and having these conversations about how they've lost walking partners, or now they go to the grocery store and people who were their friends now won't make direct eye contact with them. So there is a lot there, and it's still there. And I think we need to name that and not gloss it over and say, hey, well, you can't take a disaffiliation vote doesn't mean that that's not still there. These are real communities that have been torn apart, and that's real. Like, you take that on in that. However, in the process of this, in checking back and talking to our churches now, you see these little like shoots. Like, it's like it's spring, right? Like this, it's almost like this growth or these opportunities that they couldn't see before, they can now see because they have to, right? So you see vibrant communities and small groups starting to pop up around our conference. You see churches coming together in ways and doing ministry in ways that they probably wouldn't have done because they weren't forced to do it. Now they're forced to do it because things changed financially, membership-wise, who they engage with in the community, everything. Going around the conference too, part of the thing with the disaffiliations and that process, while painful and hard and should never be diminished for as significant, it'll be a significant mark in our history of the Great Plains, right, of the United Methodist Church. It'll be that moment. It's a benchmark moment for us. What I think we are going to see is we're going to see some real creativity come out of our people. I see our lay people being energized. I see our lay people now understanding they can lead within the local church and that they need to. Right, especially with votes that were maybe taken on more so they felt were directed from not a lay source, right?
Right. Could it be a clergy person? And in some cases also, it might have been lay people that led it, but it was a small number.
It was a small number, or it was lay people from another community.
There are definitely instances of that where people crossed over total county lines to go into a different place to rabble rouse. I mean, for lack of a better way to put that. But we saw that, and we saw then the harm that happened to the church
within that.
Really out of, I can only say, selfish reasons.
Right.
And that aftermath is not going away anytime soon.
No. But I think it's open. I believe, and I hope, right? I think it's going to help us do ministry better. I think now, after seeing what happened and how it happened, and almost like that scorched earth kind of feel that it looks, I'm not saying that that pain won't still exist. It will exist. But I think for those of us in leadership positions, I think for those of us who want to be in leadership positions, I think those of us who are lay people just that are like, I am going to church on Sunday, right? I think what's going to happen, it's going to change how we do things. I think it's going to change us in a way that ends up growing us. I'd like to think that we're going to realize the nimbleness, the connectiveness that we need. We're going to realize our strengths as well as our weaknesses and what we're going to do about them. I think you're going to see, I'm hoping, what I hope for is I think that our laity are really going to I see, even in the conversations I'm having with the churches this past year have been with laity and lay leadership. I'm not sitting on these calls with the clergy person. I'm sitting on these calls with the admin chair, the finance chair, the youth and ministries person. I'm sitting there. It's usually a group of like five people, one clergy person, four laity, and it's laity driven. And that, for me, it makes my heart sing, right?
And there's something to be said too, that a lot of those folks now, they're engaged.
Right.
They understand what their role is now, whereas before maybe it was, well, they thought their role was to come on Sunday and be counted as being mm-hmm. there and gave their offerings, and you know that's great. I think a lot of folks have realized the importance of them being engaged mm-hmm. And standing up for what they believe is what Christ would want us to do in the world.
And you see new faith communities and groups that are emerging that are lay-driven and have actually decided, some of them have decided, we want to be lay-driven at this time. This feels more comfortable for us. And I love that, that kind of piece. But you also talk around there's a lot of hope. There's hope that something will change. There's hope that we can not go another 40 plus, 50 years. I don't know, it's like, it feels like forever in this mired down in this struggle. I think there's this thing like, it is time. Let us make this decision, let us do this. And let us move into where we need to be called to be next. I think that there is now this feeling of how much that is holding us back mm-hmm. as a denomination and as a family of God.
So we've talked about the two biggest issues probably that are out there, but there are a lot of other things going on at General Conference. What are one or two others that you've been touched by that you think are important for people to remember and understand or follow as it goes through the process?
I always think that General Conference is one of those things that you pay attention at your own risk at times, because the one thing, it was described to me going into this back as somebody had mentioned 2012, which just is horrifying to me that had happened, that it's been that long since Tampa. But that was my first one, was Tampa. I was part of the last Nebraska delegation that was ever seated at General Conference. Before we became the Great Plains. So that was how many years ago? And so I think that it's one of those, you can see the best of the church and the worst of the church at any point in like a 5-minute span, right? But I think the things to pay attention to is, I think one of the parts of General Conference, it's a good reminder of the global nature of our church, mm-hmm. that it's not just about us, right? Us from the U.S. perspective, right? It's a global nature of the church. We're like, it's little mini, I could describe it as a little mini UN. We all have our little headsets and everything. And it's a very interesting, like once you re-engage in the world after General Conference, it's the weirdest process, right? Kind of thing. So there's that. I think that pay attention to, there is a new book of social principles, the new document that's out. I encourage people who were there really passionate into that social principles and that social justice nature of who we are as United Methodists to take a look at that social principles document. It is available online to kind of skim through and look at.
We have it on the Great Plains website. There's a General Conference. It's greatplainsumc.org/GCUMC. I got to get it right. If you had saved old bookmarks, get rid of them, because the stuff was outdated. Remember, we're kind of going through time. This is actually the 2020 General Conference in 2024. On that, inside the legislation area, there is a link specifically to the social principles, and we have the full document posted.
And the social principles, really, it tightens it. I'll be honest, it tightens things up. It clarifies things. It puts things into better context than what it was. Because remember, the social principles is like, we created these, and then we just added on. Right. And so it became
often
this
from a U.S. perspective,
and it became a glommy, messed up document. And so what this does is it fine tunes, it streamlines it. It takes that messiness out, but it also provides that global perspective and encourages that, again, the global nature of the church, the things that while we might not see them as significant or we question why is this even important, it is significantly important to our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world. And I think that we we need to, and this document of social principles honors that and looks at that a lot closely and aligns that better into who we are. And remember, even though we just talked about regionalization and the nimbleness and the context and stuff, the social principles is still a document that is part of the general church, the global nature of the general church. So it does need to honor the voices and the perspectives of all of us within that document. Now, you can have offshoots within your regions and your central conferences and all of that, but really this is our guiding, it is a guiding document of our principles and who we are and who we say we are, right?
Right. In closing, I want to talk a little bit about, so those of us, there are a lot of us who are going to be in Charlotte, North Carolina. We go through that week, which is legislative time. We have a Sunday off. We'll find out. And then that next week is the plenary time. And it goes all the way till Friday. I know my flight is booked for Saturday morning.
Yeah, you never book a flight out on Friday night because
never.
I'll be honest, I have yet to be to a general conference that doesn't go up against, and I'm not kidding you, go up against the last moment we can be in the building according to the contract that we signed with the convention center on Friday night.
My whole point for that is there's going to be a lot of folks back here in Kansas and Nebraska who some of them have maybe not even thought about what General Conference is until all of the stuff with disaffiliation came up. Why do you think it's important for them to pay attention? And what do you hope they get out of the process back here at home while we're there?
So there's what I hope you part of General Conference, the reason we pay attention to is because this is what guides us, right? Like, this is our governing body. If you are a Nebraskan, when I say this, it's going to make sense. It is like watching the unicameral do a 60-day session. It is a sprint, and it's fast and furious. So you do the legislative time, then you do the plenary time, and before you know it, it's over. Right? For Kansans, I know you have two houses, so I think it does a little bit different. I only know the one house governing process, but that idea, it does. It looks like the unicameral, right? Kind of thing.
I've lived in both states. I think it does look like the unicameral.
Yeah. So so there's that. I always warn people to remember that which, if you know your Schoolhouse Rock and the song, I'm Just a Bill, it's that which starts now in the books that we have of legislation, which, by the way, we have the original book from 2020, most of outdated, so then they've addendum to it. So now we have new legislation that's been influenced by the past few years. All that legislation may not look the same by the time it actually even hits the plenary floor. And I always like to warn people that what starts out now, the discussions we're having now, even this conversation I'm having with Todd now about what we think is going to happen, right? Or these are the bills. This may not be what actually happens when we gathered into the space, people have met and had conversations or any of that. We also have the ability to amend and strike down and all of that kind of stuff. It's parliamentary procedure at its finest. So that's what we start with, is not necessarily what hits the floor, right? If it even gets to the floor, because we have the legislative committees and stuff. So always proceed with General Conference in a caution of knowing that what may or may not be passed may not even be written the way it started out with on April 23rd. Right?
Anything can happen.
It is anything that can happen. But we pay attention to it because this is how we govern ourselves as United Methodist Church. This is how we make the statements of what we stand for and or against and all of those pieces, parts. This is what frames us and organizes us as a body. And it is where we come together. It's the only time that we come together as the global church. In its true form, right? And so it's the only time that we get to sit in the same physical space as a global church, representation from that global church. So there's that. I also caution people, there's a couple things. You can watch it via the live stream if you want to do that. I have not experienced this because I have never watched the live stream. I have heard that is very hard to watch at times because you don't always have the context of what's happening. You only get the camera view and what's happening on stage.
It is largely, because that's actually what we watch in the press room. And so I will attest that what you see is a close-up of the dais. If somebody is speaking, they've got cameras pinpointed on the microphones that people will go to. you do not get a feel for the entire room. I mean, they have some wide shots, but honestly, those are tough to pull together because it's dark. It's just there's some logistic reasons for why you don't get to see the whole thing all the time. But I think Lisa's right. You don't get a great feel for the context of the entire floor.
Of the entire floor, and also the process that's led us into those spaces and those discussions, which I understand becomes extraordinarily difficult to process when you're sitting at your computer in your home office. Right, for lack of better terms. So remembering that if you do decide to watch the live stream, I always say, take that with that context. Know there's other things that are happening. Practice self-care in that, because there are hard discussions. Things are said in the heat of the moment from those microphones that I just always practice self-care with anything that you do when it relates to general conference kind of thing. If you are going to tune into the beauty of it, the worship services are definitely the ways, because that's where we see the global nature of the church. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention, tune into the worship service where we commission our missionaries and our deaconesses and our home missioners. That reminds us of who we put into action.
Reminds us of our heritage, number one. Mm-hmm. And it also encourages us, because that's people who are on boots on the ground ministry.
Yes, and also, word on the street has it that our bishop has been invited to preach, and I believe it's the May 1st.
Indeed he will. He'll be preaching on May 1st, so we will provide a lot more information about that. And now that I've said that, I don't know if May 1st or May 2nd, both will leave my head. Either way, we will make sure that everyone knows exactly when he's going to be preaching, to make sure you know that that's what he's going to be doing with that. I've got to hear what scripture he's using. It's going to be good.
Always going to be good when our bishop is preaching. But those are, when you're going to tune in there. Remember that the legislative committees are not streamed.
Correct.
So
yeah, they basically can only stream the things in the plenary room. There are 14 committees, right?
Yeah.
There's no way to stream 14. Not that the cost of that would just be astronomical. So things in the plenary space. So you'll have things every day. Every morning there is a worship time that will be streamed. There are some plenary times for those celebrations, like Lisa was just talking about, when they're commissioning of various folks. There's a celebration of UMCOR, I believe, this year.
This should be.
I was just trying to remember. The entire schedule actually is on our website. I typed it all in to make sure that it was all in a table for everybody to see. But even that, keep in mind, that's what we're going with going in. The schedule can change. There's a meeting every morning
to change the schedule.
What the schedule will be like.
And the days are long and the days are hard. And so say that. Todd's mentioning of the legislative committees is also reminds me, I think this is one of the things to remember. As the Great Plains, we have one of the largest delegations that is seated on the floor, which means that we actually have vote and voice in all of the legislative committees. Not every conference says that or has that ability, but we do. So that allows the Great Plains to greatly influence all that is happening within that. So engagement process is, you know, there is an email address and I'm sure is up there. If you want to share with any of the delegation, that is a great way to share with us your thoughts, you know, what you hope to see, all of that kind of thing. I also tell, you know, there's always that moment of just take a moment to take that moment of prayer. And think about just all of us going into the process, your hopes and dreams for the church, you know, that conversation with God is always helpful within the process. Ways to educate congregations or the lay people around you. Sunday school class discussions are always good. There's always opportunities in any moments to have those conversations, ask the questions, get those thoughts to it. I like, obviously, because Todd's sitting like not 5 feet away from me, I will say, always go to the Great Plains website to get your up-to-date information. But also United Methodist News Service is my other trusted source. It is hard to sift through all the information that's coming at you. It's like it's drinking from a fire hydrant, and you don't know whether it's valid news or not valid news. Here's my two suggestions of your most valid news sources. It's going to be our Great Plains website, and they share a lot of things from the news service and the United Methodist News Service. Those are the two that I rely on as my information gathering sources, plus the news service pulls from other conferences, so you get the perspective across the global church, so that is helpful. And if you're not subscribing subscribing to it, to that digest anyway, you probably should, just to, you know, be engaged and informed, kind of thing.
We'll have a link on that in that general conference area on our website. We don't have it up there right now, but we will by the time general conference begins. There's a lot of preview information there. So some of the major legislative components, there are some lead-in types of things to at least get you educated on what the topics are. We do not get into the weeds on a lot of that stuff.
No.
But it's going to be, it's going to give you a brief overview of what those subjects are. We have an area there that is for your congregation. So if you have questions or things that you want to try to share with your congregation, there are some resources there to help you with that. Methodist Communications have put together a few things that we have, and we have some videos that we're shooting, this podcast series, all that stuff is there, and we certainly hope that you will share that and that folks will get to learn because of you sharing it.
Right, and be a part. Know that you are part of the discussion and the process, and there are ways to engage in that. Also, you know, you can reach out to the conference lay leadership team. Two of us are actually will be voting on the floor, and the third member of the conference lay leadership team has a lot of general conference experience as well, and knows how to sift through the information, and we can help you just even figuring out how to talk to your church. Of course, we're going to direct you to a lot of the resources on the Great Plains because we've helped Todd and his team with putting that together, kind of thing. This is not an easy time for our church. This is a hard time for our church. It's always hard a general conference year because our anxiety is high, and our anxiety ratchets up. And in our moments of anxiety, it feels so overwhelming. It feels so much. Remember that the process does not end with general conference. If there are any constitutional amendments that are being made, it has to go back to the general, back to each annual conference to get a two-thirds vote. Which then, if you were looking for a ways to engage in the general conference process, and this is me doing a self-promotion moment, Todd.
I know where you're going with this.
If there's a way that you would like to engage in the general conference process and be a part of that decision making, if anything needs to go to an annual conference, it becomes vital then that your lay member to annual conference from your local churches goes to annual conference, and that you as a church help that person get there. Select and send that person. We also have at-large lay member spots. Contact the conference lay leadership team if you yourself do not have a vote from your church but would like to be part of that process. Those constitutional amendments won't come this annual conference, but they will circle back next. So in the annual conference in 2025 is when anything that we have had that requires a two-thirds annual conference vote will come to our annual conference. So there's a way to really be advocates and engage in that process. So that's one of those things that I just, you know, have to say. You just because you're not at general conference, we actually as an annual conference get moments to have say in a lot of those things. And that will include the restrictive language. That will include regionalization and some of these big topics that we have talked about.
Absolutely. And we'll let that be the last word. One thing I guess I will say is if you do want to send an email to the delegation, which is an equal number of clergy and laity, we seat 7 of each on the floor, so that's 14 people total. You can send that email to gcdelegates@greatplainsumc.org. That's gcdelegates@greatplainsumc.org. There is a link on our, again, in that general conference area of our website. If you click on delegation, their names come up. There's information about what the delegates for the entire general conference, not just ours, you know, but like, what's the makeup, what's the demographics, those types of things. So you have that information. But there's a big button right in the middle that allows you to hit that, and it will bring that into your email, and you can send that. Lisa, thanks for spending time with me today.
Yeah, thank you.
I hope you gained some insight from Lisa's reflections on General Conference. We recorded this episode just prior to recording 2 videos with her and 4 other delegates to the General Conference at Countryside United Methodist Church in Topeka, Kansas, just a few weeks ago. I so appreciate Lisa taking time with me, not just for those videos, but also to talk with me for this episode. If you're keeping score, this makes 2 of the 5 promised interviews. We've heard from Reverend Mark Holland, the founder of Mainstream UMC, and now from Lisa Maupin. Next time, we'll hear from Reverend David Livingston, pastor of Old Mission United Methodist Church in Fairway, Kansas. He's been one of the best sources for following developments in the denomination since the 2019 special session of General Conference. I know you'll learn a lot from his discussion with me. So we'll see you next time. In Layman's Terms is a podcast sponsored by the Great Plains Conference of the United Methodist Church and by me, your host, Todd Seifert. If you like what you've heard in this episode, please go rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening. It helps others find us. And if you're so inclined, please share the link to this podcast on your social media channels. Our music and sound effects come via subscriptions to Universal Production Music and to Storyblocks. You can find archived episodes on the conference website at www.greatplainsumc.org/podcasts or on my website, toddseifert.com. Please email me with any questions or comments to tseifert@greatplainsumc.org, and I'll do my best to respond as quickly as possible. Thank you for listening, and until next time, please do what you can to help make more disciples of Jesus Christ. You can play a small part in helping change a life.